with all of you. I invite you to open your Bibles to 1 Samuel 25. I don't remember what month was I here last. Was that in October or something? It's good to see a lot of you again. I tried to remember some of your names. I didn't get all of them. But I enjoy living close enough to be able to be part of this summer series. Excited to have this topic assigned to me. I've never preached a sermon on 1 Samuel 25, looking at the story of Abigail. But have you ever had a friend before who stopped you from doing something that you were going to do that you shouldn't have ever even thought about doing? When I was a new Christian, I can't tell you how many conversations I had with people where I said, I'm thinking about this or I'm thinking about that. And God's people, in their love and their concern for me, said, you know, maybe have you thought about this direction or not doing this or not doing that? So many of those conversations helped form the decisions that I made and have impacted the way that I continue to make analogous decisions whenever I'm in situations that are similar to that. But you guys are in a series of lessons on the life of David. And David was somebody who was surrounded by lots of good people that helped him. A lot of outliers in his life would be one way that you could say that. A lot of people that maybe don't come to the prominence that David did. But without those people in his life, he wouldn't have been the person that we remember him for being today. And one of those people in his life was Abigail. And we don't really read a lot about her outside of this story. But she does something for David that's so critical and so important, that is one of the things that contributes to us remembering David for who he is. Now, as you guys are going through this series of lessons on David, most of your texts are probably coming from 1 and 2 Samuel. And before I look specifically at this story, I want to say something about 1 and 2 Samuel as a whole to frame what we're looking at tonight. But originally, 1 and 2 Samuel would have been one book. The scrolls couldn't hold any more than 32 feet from what I've read, so if it went beyond that, they had to cut it into two books. So there's not a different theme in 1 Samuel as opposed to 2 Samuel. The theme of 1 Samuel is the same theme of 2 Samuel. So if you think about Samuel as comprising 1 and 2 Samuel, what's the theme of the book of Samuel? And at the beginning of the book of Samuel, in the middle of the book of Samuel, and the end of the book of Samuel, there's a poem. And each of these poems shares a same theme of God taking prideful people and humbling them, and God taking humble people and exalting them. The first time that you see something like that is with Hannah's prayer, talking about both of my daughters' names, Abigail and Hannah. In Hannah's prayer, she says this, that God raises up the poor from the dust. Remember, in the context, Hannah is married to a man named Elkanah, and he's married to another woman as well, Peninnah, and they're having fights about, you know, Hannah's not able to get pregnant, and she prays to God, and she eventually has Samuel. And so she praises God and says that God takes the poor people and raises up the poor from the dust. In the middle of Samuel, or 2 Samuel chapter 1, after Saul has died, David says three times, how the mighty have fallen, how the mighty have fallen, how the mighty have fallen. The last poem in Samuel is 2 Samuel 22, which is the same thing as Psalm 18. And it's a long psalm, but here's a sampling of what David said, referring to what God has done for him. You save a humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty to bring them down. God has lifted up David and saved David and taken him from the ash heap and brought him up into this prominence that he had. But God takes the prideful and the haughty and he casts them down. The theme of Samuel is that God takes humble people and he lifts them up, and he takes prideful people and he casts them down. Every single story in Samuel fits that theme without exception. You think about Eli and his sons, the prideful priests. They are humbled, and at the same time, who's being exalted? You've got Samuel, the prophet, being exalted. What about David and Goliath? You've got the prideful Goliath that's being toppled over, while at the same time, David is being exalted. This story that we're looking at tonight fits the same mold. There's going to be a man that's very prideful, that's brought low, and David, who ends up being humble in this story, is raised up even more. But let's get our bearings for what we're looking at in the life of David. This is what you guys are looking at for this summer series. And on the 13th, was it? David Dieselkamp preached on David being the hero. I assume that was about the story of David and Goliath. That David topples over Goliath, and everybody's singing his praises. At this point, he's been anointed to become the king, but he doesn't yet have the throne. But because of all the fame he's getting, because of what he's done with Goliath, Saul, the current king, becomes jealous. And so on July 20th, you guys had a lesson on King Saul and David in waiting, where I assume that you guys looked at the jealousy that King Saul had for David and the patience that David had to have before he was able to be enthroned as the king. David's in a difficult situation when we come to this story that we're looking at. He's had to flee from King Saul because King Saul has been trying to kill him, and it puts David in the position of being an outlaw. He's got unfulfilled promises as a king, and he has to flee from the king that's currently reigning. Look at 1 Samuel 22, and look at verses 1 and 2, and see a couple chapters before what we're looking at, what happens here. In 1 Samuel 22, verses 1 and 2, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was in bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became commander over them. And there were with him about 400 men. So here's David fleeing to a cave, and he gets 400 of the choicest people in the nation flocking to him. No. It was people that were in debt, they were embittered, they were in distress. These are the people that come to him, 400 people at this cave. In verse 13 of chapter 25, we're going to find that David's got a total of 600 people. So there's more people flocking to him. But David's on the run from King Saul, and he's in this difficult situation. I've got 600 men that have got to have provisions. They've got to have work to do. And how do I take care of these people by, at the same time, not looking like a traitor? This is the story that we're looking at tonight. This story opens up in 1 Samuel 25. What I'm going to do for this lesson is I'm going to tell the story, and you can follow along if you'd like in 1 Samuel 25. I'm going to tell the story, and then after I tell the story, we're going to come back and look at a few things to see some applications from this. But this story opens up with the death of Samuel. Samuel being a very important person, the guy who anointed David. Can you imagine David in the wilderness and some messenger comes up to him and says, hey, this guy that anointed you king, this guy that you leaned on for support at times, he's now dead. David's immediate response is to go to the wilderness of Paran or Paran or something like that. This is ironically the same place that the Israelites were at in Numbers 13 when the 12 spies returned, 10 of which were unfaithful in the book of Numbers, and they discouraged all the people in this location in the wilderness. They were tested in this place, and they failed the test. When you think of the wilderness in the Bible, you think of a place of testing. And here's David in this same location, and he's about to be tested. And in this, the vicinity of where David is, there's a married couple that are so polar opposite of one another. Nabal, this man, the first thing that we learn about is that he's very rich. He's got a bunch of sheep, he's got a bunch of goats. The first thing that we see, the first thing that he's defined by are his riches. But we also see that it wasn't just that he was rich, he was harsh and he was badly behaved. He didn't have these riches because God was looking at his faithfulness and blessing him. He was a harsh man that perhaps gained his wealth through that kind of character that he had. But his name literally means fool. And he's going to be aptly named as we see in this story. Have you ever seen husbands and wives that you wonder, like, how did they ever get connected with each other? They don't seem to belong to each other at all. His wife's name was Abigail. And the text says that she was discerning and she was beautiful. Now, both of these people are going to live up to their descriptions as we see in this story, but try to imagine this. So we're introduced to those people, and they're in the vicinity of where David is, and David is out in the back country, and he hears one day that Nabal is shearing his sheep. This would have been a time of the year where it was like payday. It was great festivities. Later on in this story, Nabal will in fact be having a great feast. And so while all of these festivities are happening because of the sheep shearing, David sends some people to Nabal. And if you look at this in verse 6 in the story, David gives one of the most elaborately kind greetings that you'll find in all the Bible. Three times. In verse 6, he says, "Peace be to you, peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Peace, peace, peace. We don't come to try to war against you. We're not trying to come to take advantage of you any way. But the bottom line is, these 10 people that David sends, they say, peace, peace, peace. Would you be able to spare something, anything that you have on hand for these men that are out here in the wilderness?" Now, why would David ever make this request to begin with? It's not like we read about David making any kind of business agreement with Nabal. What gives David the audacity to go up to this man with all this wealth and say, "Can you please spare whatever you have for me?" Well, it was in this time period, it was customary. In fact, if you look at verse 7, look at verse 7 in the text. "I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time that they were in Carmel." What David had been doing is protecting Nabal's flocks and protecting Nabal's men from marauding bands, maybe from the Philistines or something like that. But it was customary practice back then that whenever there were marauding bands, if somebody wanted to eventually get something by way of compensation from the people that owned all the property, if they were protecting that man's flocks from marauding bands, what was customary is that those people would then take care of them during the time of sheep shearing. So what David is requesting here might seem very odd to us, but in this culture was part of the way that they practiced these things. So here's David's 10 men, and they make this request to a man who's harsh and badly behaved and a fool. And when they give this message to Nabal, the text says that they waited for Nabal to respond. Can you imagine them coming up to this guy? They say, "Can you please spare us whatever you have?" Were his arms crossed? What was the look that he gave to these people? And he just waits for a second. And the 10 men are going, what's the answer going to be? And the first thing that Nabal says as he tears into them is, "Who is David, the son of Jesse?" Well, of course you know who David is. Everybody knows who he is because he's killed Goliath. I think what he's saying is, "Who is David to me that I should have to do anything for him like that?" And you wonder, the guys that David sent, what could they have been thinking? Who is David to you? He's the one who spared your flocks and made sure that nobody took advantage of it. He continues laying into them, though. And he says, "There's many servants these days breaking away from their masters." Think about how insulting that is. There's many servants breaking away from their masters. What is that implying about David? Well, you had a master named Saul, and you've broken away from him. How insulting this would be for David's men to hear this. No, no, no. It wasn't that David broke away from Saul. Saul made him flee for his life because he was trying to kill him. Nabal lowers the boom, though, in verse 11. Notice all the references to himself in verse 11. "Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed from my shears and give it to the men who come from I don't know where?" Depending on your translation, 7 or 8 times he refers to me, the things that I have. Why should I have to do this? I'm not even going to give you the basic necessity of water. Can you imagine being one of David's 10 men? And like the door closes and it's just silent and the men walk like 100 yards away, and what do they start talking about? How are we going to break the news to David? David is trying to take care of 600 men. What is it that we're going to do in this situation? They break the news to David. And at this point, you can imagine how discouraged David already was. But without even, it's like David doesn't even take any time to think about it. Immediately, he just says, "Every man strap on your sword." Can you hear it in your mind? All the swords getting like unsheathed, and they're cleaning them off, and they're getting their belts on. You can hear all the sound of these people getting ready to go out to battle. And here they are, 200 people left behind to protect the baggage that they have, 400 men being sent out, and they start marching over to destroy Nabal and every male in his household. And if nothing happens to stop what David's about to do, this story is going to end in a total slaughtering. But fortunately, one of these servants of Nabal was in the vicinity, or he heard, or he saw this interaction that Nabal and David's men had. And this servant goes up to Abigail, the wife of Nabal, and he says that this is what happened, and David and his men, they were like a wall to us. They protected us. They made sure that we kept everything. We didn't lose anything. And he says about Nabal that your husband is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. How bad does a husband have to be that a servant of the house, a slave of the house, can speak that way about the husband to the wife? This guy has got to be a brute. This servant, by the way, he doesn't say, well, Abigail, I think here's the idea. You should do this, you should do that. Here's the game plan. He just says, look, there's 400 people coming to kill all of us. We don't know what to do. Can you do something? Because nobody can talk to your husband. He's unreasonable. And Abigail is a brilliant woman. She makes haste right away. And she hurries up like 5 times in this story. But the first thing she does is she makes haste to prepare food. 200 loaves of bread, wine, sheep, grain, all these things. Can you imagine her doing all of this? She's busy packing all this stuff, loading it on donkeys. Her husband doesn't know at all what's going on. He's partying, getting drunk. We'll see that later on in the story. What do you think her demeanor was that whole time? Like, I don't know. I picture her shaking a little bit. Like, there's these soldiers coming, and we're going to die, and I'm getting all the donkeys loaded, and hopefully this is going to work. I don't know what's going to end up happening. But she is being very helpful here, because an angry man is oftentimes helped by food. So she's loading up all the donkey, all everything, and she starts setting out. And while David is on his donkey riding closer and closer, he's speaking to himself about how he's going to kill every man in that household. He gets to this part of a ravine or something like that, and then here comes Abigail. And when he saw her, did he pull the sword? Was he about to kill her? She immediately gets down on her face, with her face in the dirt. And what she says changes the flow of the whole story. She says a lot of things to David. It's one of the longer speeches given by a woman in the Bible. She calls David, she refers to herself as a servant of David 6 times. And she calls David my Lord 14 times in this speech. But notice in this speech what she does. A couple times she takes on guilt that doesn't even belong to her. In verse 24, the first thing she says with her face in the dirt, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. In verse 28, please forgive the trespass of your servant. She hasn't done anything, but what she's trying to do is deflect the attention from her husband onto her. If anybody be punished, have it come on me. That's not all she says, though. At the same time, she acknowledges the foolishness of her husband. She says, Nabal is his name, and folly is with this man. I'm not blind to this man's faults. But please, if anything can be done, let the guilt be put on me. The main thing that Abigail communicates to David with her face in the ground, look at verse 28. For the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. Doesn't that sound a lot like the promises that Nathan would later give to David, that you're going to be built into this sure house? Before Nathan the prophet ever says these words to David, she's like the first one that says something like that to David. She even calls back David's time, I think, making an allusion to the time that he killed Goliath in verse 29, where she says, and the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. Remember that time, David, when you killed Goliath? Remember when you were making good decisions? Look at verse 31. This is the main thing that she communicates here. My Lord shall have no cause of grief or pains of conscience for having shed blood without innocent cause. David, don't do this, because later on you're going to regret that you did this. It's going to stain your record. We're going to come back to that in just a moment. Now, can you imagine being David? And you're just breathing threats of murder against these people that you were heading towards. This woman bows down to the ground. She's got all of this food. And in the heat of the moment, have you ever had a time before where in the heat of the moment, you wanted to say something or do something that you shouldn't do, and somebody breaks in and says something that you need to hear? That says a lot about your heart, how you respond in that very moment. David says, "Blessed be the God who sent you to meet me. You have kept me from blood guilt." He immediately receives her words, and he tells her, "You go in peace." The crisis is averted. What was that like? Like, did they look at each other for a moment, and then she just gets back on the donkey, leaves all the food, and she... What was that ride home like for her? Was she still shaking a little bit, if she ever was? Was she wondering how her husband was going to respond to all of this? When she gets back home, she arrives, and her husband is having this great feast, and he's drunk. And she doesn't come up to him and slap him in the face and say, "Do you know what I did for you again?" Instead, she just goes to bed. And the next morning, she says, "All right, Nabal, your life was going to be destroyed yesterday. This army of 400 men were going to come, but I took a bunch of your food that you got, that all belongs to you, and I brought it out to him." And immediately when he hears this news, his heart died within him and he became a stone. I don't know if that means that he had a stroke or a heart attack, something like that. But 10 days later, the Lord struck him and he died. What were those 10 days like for David when he almost had shed innocent blood, in a sense, innocent blood? And he had those provisions from Abigail. And then eventually one day a messenger comes out and says that Nabal has died. And I imagine David shaking his head going, "Blessed be God who avenged me and kept me from returning evil on him." Maybe if Nabal would have stayed alive, he would have continued to create problems for David as he got closer and closer to taking the throne. But with him finding out that Nabal has died, he sends messengers to Abigail. "Do you want to marry me?" And she says, yes. Look at verse 41. "I am a servant to wash the feet of the servants of the Lord." Yeah, I'll come. And David marries her. What's the purpose of a story like this? What are we supposed to learn from the story of David and Abigail? Well, if we zero in on the main characters, Nabal, Abigail, and David, I think we can characterize them in ways that are kind of related but different. Here's what I mean by this. Nabal in this story is somebody who repays good with evil. This is exactly what David says about him in verse 21, where he says, "He has returned me evil for good." So Nabal is a man who repays good with evil. People have done good things to him and he's evil back to them. David is somebody who plans to repay evil with evil. Nabal has mistreated David for the good that he's given to him, and so David is going to get even with him. And different from all everybody else in the story is Abigail, who repays evil with good. Now, just think about those three things. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on Nabal and a little bit more time on David and Abigail. But think about, first of all, Nabal, repaying good with evil. Why was Nabal the way that he was? Well, there's a couple possibilities. Back earlier in 1 Samuel 15, verse 12, Saul, this is what it says about Saul. Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself. This is the same area that Nabal has his business operation. So is it possible that Nabal has aligned himself with a wicked ruler, and there's a statue right in his backyard, and so if he aligns himself with that man, he becomes kind of like him? There's some parallels between Nabal and Saul. They both address David in similar kinds of ways. They're both anti-David. There's other parallels that we don't have time to get into right now. But did he align himself with a wicked man and become like that wicked man? Maybe. Or maybe the guy was just obsessed with his money. He thought he was a self-made man. Look at all the things that I've done. Whatever the cause might be. He was somebody that when people were good to him, he was evil in return. Think about that in your life with other people that you've known. Are you a self-made person? Or are you able to recognize and acknowledge the people that God has put in your life that have helped you? The advice that you've been given, the ways that people have helped you financially. Here's a man that can't see any good that anybody's ever done for this guy. He's very self-centered, and he's not somebody who's able to give credit where it's due. In your life, are you the kind of person that can see good in others? Are you the kind of person that can acknowledge, oh yeah, I wouldn't be where I am if it weren't for these people in my life, and here's the ways that they've helped me? What about with God? Has God been good to you? And have you repaid God's goodness with evil towards him? Where he's forgiven you, he's given you a family in Christ, he sustains you every moment, but you, with the life that he's blessed you with, you take the energy and the talents that you have and you start dedicating it to things other than the Lord. What is that other than repaying good with evil? Remember in Ezekiel 16, where you've got the nation of Israel pictured as a little girl left on the side of the road for dead, and these people pass by and nobody cares about her at all. And then one day the Lord passes by her and he says, live, in your blood live. And she starts to grow and she eventually becomes beautiful. And then all the nations that formerly didn't want her now find her attractive, and she starts cheating on God with all these nations. What was going through her mind? Maybe the better question is to ask is what was not going on in her mind. Ezekiel 16:22 says, and in all your abominations and your whorings, you did not remember the days of your youth when you were naked and bare, wallowing in your blood. One of the biggest problems that I think we have as Christians, one of the biggest fights that we have as Christians, is to see how good we have it in the Lord. To be reminded of what God has done for us so that we will become people who repay the goodness that God has given to us with good in return, that we don't become harsh and badly behaved people, that if we can't see the good that God has done to us, we'll never be able to repay the good with the good that we've been given. What is it that God does with people who repay good with evil? In this story, in verse 38, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. On judgment day, how many of God's people will be struck down? Because despite all the things God gave you, you made video games your God, or you made this other thing, you made money your God, you made the nation your God, you made all these, look at how you didn't repay God with all the good that he gave you. And in that sense, we have to be warned against being a Nabal, somebody who, whenever somebody's good to him, he just repays it with evil. Well, I want to spend a little bit more time on David, though. In this story, David plans to repay evil with evil, which is really not so atypical. This is the way that people just kind of are. Somebody's mean to you, and you go, well, I'm going to get even with them, or I'm going to get a little bit more than even with them. What's really strange, though, is the contrast of what David did in the chapter right before this and what he will do in the chapter right after this. Have you ever noticed this before? The chapter right before this, David has an opportunity to kill somebody, Saul, who's been mistreating him. And in 1 Samuel 24, verse 6, it says, he says to his men who are urging him to kill Saul, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to do that, guys. We're in the cave of Adullam. Saul comes up there to use the bathroom. He cuts off some of his robe, but I will not kill the guy. And then in chapter 26, when David is talking to Abishai, he says, do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? So the chapter before this, the chapter after this, David restrains himself and says, I will not kill somebody who's mistreating me. But in the chapter in between, he's about to do it. What makes it in this story to make it three chapters in a row where he restrains himself from killing somebody who has been mistreating him? Well, look at what Abigail's advice was in verses 30 and 31. I said I wanted to come back to this. It's not going to be on the PowerPoint. Look at 1 Samuel 25, verses 30 and 31. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all that the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood with innocent blood without cause. For my Lord working salvation for himself, and when the Lord has dealt with you well with my Lord, then remember your servant. What is it that Abigail is saying here in verse 31? There's going to come a time where you're exalted and the Lord has done everything that he said he was going to do for you. You don't want to look back at this moment and regret what you've done. One way that you could say this is she's saying to David, David, what story do you want to tell about this moment? What story do you want to tell people? Because every moment you're living is eventually going to become a memory that you'll be able to tell in the future about what you did in the past. Did I say all that right? I think I did. You know what I mean, though. Every moment, every decision that you have to make will eventually become some story that you're going to tell somebody. Do you want the stories that you tell people, the I got even kind of stories? Oh, yeah, there's that one time when so-and-so did this, and I said this back to them. Oh, yeah, that's real cool. Here's Abigail saying, do you want to look back on this moment and have to tell people that I repaid evil with evil? I didn't live, and I know Christ wasn't around yet, but I didn't choose the Jesus path where he's teaching us to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. We're going to see some of that kind of thing with Abigail herself. But think about this for yourself right now. Maybe last week you made some good decisions. Maybe next week you're going to make some good decisions. But maybe this week there's some things that you're really struggling with. And whatever you're struggling with, you've got a choice. And you have to ask yourself, like what Abigail's getting David to think about, what story do I want to tell about the decision I'm about to make? It wasn't just that Abigail had this wisdom here. What if David didn't have the meekness and the humility to receive these words? I mean, again, David was on his donkey rehearsing and mumbling to himself, I'm going to kill all those people. And in the midst of that kind of anger, here she comes and he receives her words. It reminds me of James chapter 1, verse 21. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save yourselves. What if David didn't put away the filthiness and didn't put away the rampant wickedness of his evil that he had in his heart towards this man? If he didn't put that away, he wouldn't have been able to receive with meekness the word. David is a man after God's own heart. And that doesn't mean that he was perfect. We all know that. But what it does mean is that in moments where he was hot with anger, or moments where somebody challenges him about his life, if whenever they're right, he'll go, that's right, I'm wrong. David planned to repay evil with evil. Are there any emotions in your life right now getting the better of you? Are there any decisions that you're about to make that are going to become regrets in the future? You need to have people in your life that are wise to give you the instructions that you need, but at the same time, you need to have the heart to receive. Have you ever had a time before where somebody told you, well, you know, I think you need to forgive that person, or I think you need to pray for that person, or I think you need to, and they gave you the advice of Scripture, and your response was, nope, you don't know my story. Do you see that? That's not the heart of David. And David, because of his heart here, is able to walk free. He's able to walk free of vengeance. He's able to walk free of bad memories. He's able to do the right thing, which is why he says, blessed be the God who sent you to me to warn me about these things. Those are some things that I learned from David, but then finally, some things that we learn from Abigail, who is different from everybody, who even when people are evil towards her, she's making haste to do good for them. She shows good both to Nabal and to David. You think about, first of all, how she shows good towards Nabal. She made haste to make a bunch of food to save his life. Now, was she doing this more for David, or was she doing it more for Nabal? I don't know. Let's just say for imagination's sake, she'd been married for 7 years to Nabal. What have these 7 years been like for her? Grueling and agonizing, torturous, like the worst marriage that you could imagine for her, married to a guy like this. And when she finds out that David is coming to kill this guy, she doesn't go, well, I'm going to go on vacation for a little bit. I'm just going to back off and let fate run its course. She does what she can to save her husband. She could have just let it all happen. Is there anybody in your life that's harmed or insulted you in some way? Anybody that you've been holding a grudge against? That something that they said a long, long time ago? Think about this in your life. What would it look like practically to proactively bless somebody who's been adversarial towards you? This is not an option for Christians, by the way. This is what's commanded for Christians. You don't get an option with this one. You love those who persecute you. You pray for those who are adversaries against you. When God's people are operating at optimum levels, we should all be working through the things that we've done against each other. And here's Abigail modeling that for us. So you see that she's showing that towards Nabal, but she's also showing this towards David. She's doing good to David, who's getting ready to kill a bunch of people. And rather than assembling a bunch of soldiers together, what she does is she assembles a bunch of food, quite literally doing what Romans 12 verses 20 and 21 says. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. What is more powerful than evil? Well, it would have to be whatever can overcome evil. And what is it in this text that can overcome evil? Good. Now, I understand that we live in the kingdom of Christ, which operates on different principles than the nations do. And I'm going to say something, but I don't mean it in a disparaging way against nations. I'm just saying this is how it is in those nations, and this is how it ought to be with Christians. We live in the midst of countries, and a country that's got a military, and we've got tanks, and we've got weapons, and the way that we overcome evil is by dropping bombs on people and things. And that's just the way that the nations work. And the way of the Christian is to say, okay, well, the thing that's more powerful than evil, the thing that will truly eradicate evil, the thing that can overcome it is goodness. And you go look at some of the protests that people like Martin Luther King did, the peaceful kind of, those did so much. The way of Jesus is that you do good to your enemies, and what it does is it shames them. Here's Abigail, and she comes with all of this food, and it's like heaping hot coals on David's head. He feels ashamed for the things that he was about to do, and he's been overcome with the goodness that Abigail has shown towards him. Now, how is Abigail described at the beginning of this whole story? She is discerning. Do you want to know what discerning people do? I'm not making any statements about Christians joining the military or being in the police force. That's not my point. I'm saying with how Christians operate in the kingdom of Christ, what is the way that we think about overcoming evil? It's with good. Praying for our enemies. It's for feeding them. Whatever it is that they might need, this is more powerful than had Abigail come with another 400 set of soldiers and they had a fight. This humble service of bringing food to these people does more good than arming up another 400 group of people. And as you think about Nabal or David or Abigail, the most unique in all of these people is Abigail. And this is what every Christian ought to think like. She's a model of exactly what is taught in the New Testament. Now, you see all of these important, valuable moral lessons in a story like this. I think we would be remiss if we just looked at these stories and looked for moral lessons, which we should do. And all of these lessons are very valuable. But we also know that Jesus had spoken about how all of the Old Testament looks forward to him. Do you see any foreshadowings of Jesus in a story like this? You can look at it from two different perspectives. Is there any ways in which Abigail is modeling Jesus? Two times in this story, she's wanting to take on burdens that don't even belong to her. On me be the guilt. forgive the part, forgive the wrongs that I've done. In verse 28, even though she hadn't done any wrongs, but on me be the guilt. Does that sound like Isaiah 53, where the suffering servant is taking on all these burdens that don't belong to him? She's modeling later on what Jesus is going to do. Or in verse 41, when she offers to even wash the feet of David's servants. What did Jesus later do in the Gospel of John? Well, what about David? Are there any ways that David represents Christ in this? Well, David resists violence to accomplish God's will. I understand at the beginning of the story, he was going to show violence. But in the end, he doesn't. Remember when Jesus is being arrested and he says to Peter after he cuts off Malchus's ear, he says, do you not think that I cannot appeal to my Father and that he will not at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? Jesus could have stopped everything that was happening, but he resists violence to accomplish God's will, just like David does in this story. But maybe the final thing is that at the end of this story, David acquires a bride who was formerly married to a harsh ruler. Now, if you word it right, you can see the parallels. Do you see that? Do you know who we used to be aligned with? Everybody is wedded to something. Some people are wedded to their job. Some people are wedded to a philosophy. Some people are wedded to money or whatever it could be. Whatever you yoke yourself to that's not Jesus is a harsh ruler. You imagine being Abigail married to a harsh man for 7 years. Maybe some of you don't have to imagine that very much because you've lived a long time. You can remember back to the times when you yoked yourself to something other than Jesus and it brought you down and low and you were depressed and you were constantly upset about one thing or another because you weren't letting the right master be your guide. And when that harsh ruler dies, the son of David, ultimately, what is this a foreshadowing of? There's so many stories about the damsel in distress and then the knight in shining armor coming and rescuing his bride. This woman was in distress and God took care of that husband and then she got somebody who it seemed was better in a heightened way. Jesus has come and he's defeated the biggest enemy that we had, which was sin and Satan and death. And life under that ruler is harsh. He's delivered us from that so that we can be yoked to him. Has Jesus delivered you from that? Has Jesus taught you to live the way that Abigail lived? And to be somebody who knows that their fulfillment and their longings are all found in Christ. And because of that, I don't need to grab things from people like Nabal did. I can be somebody who freely gives because I've been freely given to. Have you been changed by the Son of David? Have you humbled yourself so that one day you can be exalted? If there's anybody here tonight that needs to consider those things, I hope that the story of Abigail and David and Nabal has been helpful for you to consider. But it's been very good to be with all of you tonight. And I always enjoy the times that we can spend together. I appreciate again and thank you guys for having me be part of this series. But I love you guys and it's good to be reconnected. And we're going to have a prayer now. Is that right?